So it's October 2000. The place is a gray, cinder block, windowless conference room in the administrative wing of the Catalina Mountain School, a juvenile prison 12 miles north of Tucson, Arizona. A self-confident young man, 17 years old, walks into the room. He closes the door behind him, seats himself across the conference table. I turn on a tape recorder. I give him a code name, CMS-66. He says he's from the north side of town. He says that he was in pre-dental program at the Pima County Community College before coming to the Catalina Mountain School. He says that he's been incarcerated for 3 months now on a gun charge, and that he's served time previously for possession of a firearm, a Glock 40, a pretty powerful, relatively expensive semi-automatic weapon. I show him three colored pictures of handguns taken from articles in the American Handgunner magazine. The first is an HS-2000 full-size 9mm service pistol from IM Metal of Croatia. It's a black, plastic-looking, it's polymer, pistol that resembles closely a Glock or a Sig 9. The second is a Para Ordnance P-14 LDA. This is a full-size 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol with a 5-inch barrel, and it looks like a classic Beretta or Ruger 45. The third is a Smith & Wesson 45 Colt CTG revolver. It's the traditional 45. He looks at the pictures, and in a nonchalant, cool voice, pointing to each picture in turn as he speaks, he says, "Glock, Beretta, Smith & Wesson." CMS-66 knows his guns. The first picture of the 9mm resembles the Glock 40 that he used to have. The others, well, he learned about them from his father and from his friends. His dad collected guns. He had a Dan Wesson 357 revolver, a Smith & Wesson 44 revolver, and an SKS assault rifle. It was probably one of the Chinese ripoffs. His dad taught him to respect guns. Now, the way CMS tells it, he received the Glock 40 for Christmas as a present when he was 15 years old from his best friend, who was 5 years older. "He got it to me brand new in the box," CMS explains, "with two clips. And the real bad thing about the gun, he gave it to me with Teflon bullets, you know, armor piercing. But I got rid of those. I gave them back. I don't plan on shooting anyone with a bulletproof vest, so he can keep them. That was his thing." His friend's thing was the drug trade. CMS 66 started hanging out with his older friend when he was about 13. It was about the time that his father died. And his older friend started selling crack and then gradually progressed to larger amounts of powder cocaine. CMS 66 stuck closely with his older buddy, and soon enough he started to know the other dealers. Armed with his Glock 40, CMS 66 began leading two lives. One was in the drug trade, and a separate life at school. He was a pretty good student at school, and that life was pretty disconnected to guns, drugs, and the street. He went on to community college, and his peers there were a lot less impressed by guns. This is CMS 66. "One friend that I was getting a ride home from Pima, he seen me take my gun out of my waist and put it under the seat. He was just, 'Whatever, man, just keep it away from me, man.'" What does CMS 66 think about guns today? People need to understand that guns are dangerous, you know? People need to understand that they're a very dangerous thing. In the wrong hands, they're deadly. Even myself, I'm still a child. I shouldn't be possessing guns. Maybe when I'm 21. CMS 66 was first incarcerated for possession of the Glock 40. He's now at Catalina again. His parole officer came by his house, searched his room, and found a shotgun. So how should we begin to think about CMS 66 and his possession of a shotgun, even after he was incarcerated for possession of the Glock 40. How should we make sense of his gun carrying? The fact is, legal rules are in place. It's criminal for him to have a gun. They are also enforced. He's been incarcerated twice for lengthy periods. And yet he continued to offend. Is there anything that we can learn from CMS 66? Now, looking back, it's pretty clear that we drew a lot of conclusions from youths like him. Fueled by an epidemic of gun violence, of youth gun violence in the late 1980s and early 1990s, we made a tremendous change to our criminal laws and juvenile justice in this country. The epidemic is pretty clear here. The bottom line on all of these are non-gun homicides, and the top line are gun homicides. And then it's cut up into three different groups by age. And basically, you can see pretty clearly that the homicide peak that occurred in about 91, 92 was driven predominantly by gun homicides by youths between the ages of 18 and 24, right? The top graph right there. And also between 14 and 17. But if you look at practically all of the other trends, they were downward. So, based on this kind of perceived epidemic of gun violence, we changed our laws radically. Many states enacted laws requiring automatic transfer of juveniles to adult court for serious gun offenses. Others lowered the age for discretionary transfer by the prosecutor. Others increased the prosecutor's power to file a juvenile gun case directly in the adult system. We created blended juvenile-adult sentences. So that youths would have to serve first a term in juvenile detention, and then when they reached 18, would have to serve a subsequent term in the adult system. We also invented juvenile gun courts, which were kind of gun courts, courts specifically tailored to first-time gun offenders, intending to send a clear and lengthy message about gun violence. So across the country, our attitude towards youths changed. We cracked down, increased the sentences, and began treating youths as adults. Now, some will argue that that was long overdue, that the juvenile justice system was always, in some sense, founded on faulty assumptions about individual responsibility and youthful immaturity. But what's clear is that you can't really make policy unless you know what these guns mean to these youths, what carrying a gun conveys to appear, what the gun possession is all about. And it's crucial to explore the symbolic dimensions of guns and youth gun carrying from within the phenomenon itself. And that's what I set out to do in this project. Using systematic random sampling, I chose 30 of the 150 boys at the Catalina Mountain School to interview in depth. I developed an analytic method that integrated qualitative interviews with this experimental free associational prompt of showing the pictures, map analysis for coding the interviews, and then a multivariate statistical approach to graphing the relationship between the social meaning variables. And what I discovered, more than anything, was this rich world of sensual, moral, and political economic dimensions to gun carrying among these youths. Guns have a remarkably powerful, sensual, almost sexual dimension to them. I began all the interviews with these three pictures and a free associational prompt, and a few of the youths expressed visceral reaction to the guns, a visceral opposition, calling them dumb or stupid or pussy shit. Anybody can fight with a gun. Anybody can pull a trigger, says this 17-year-old kid. It takes somebody like a real man to fight somebody. But a far greater number, more than half of them, were just filled with lust. The sight of the handguns inspired this deep sense of awe, an immediate kind of visceral kind of sense of awe, this kind of moaning, groaning, slight giggle. They're cool. I want to play with them. I want to go out and shoot them. Guns are nice. I just like guns a lot. I'd like to have one of these. I want to go shoot them. I want to see how they handle. They look tight. They look nice. These are the immediate responses as I showed the pictures. They're nice looking guns. I kind of like how they look. I want to go shoot them. Those are some tight guns. I love guns. Hell yeah, I love guns. I love everything about a gun. Those are some pretty tight guns. I think they're cool. I like them. They're nice. Smiling. It's just tight right there. I like it. It's just like tight the way it looks. I'd say those are pretty tight. They look cool. The book was originally going to be called Strapped Tight. Strapped is what a strap is what the gun is called from the holster, and the notion of tightness was really important. But my editor told me that it would be misplaced in the bookstore under kind of the wrong rubric, if that's what it's called. So it became Language of the Gun. But that was the kind of the feeling, right? 17-year-old kid tries to explain to me. Everybody likes guns these days, dude. Hell yeah. They're exciting. I mean, what the hell? You feel powerful when you have a gun. You get respect. It's difficult to express in words the richness of the emotions. And I'm always tempted to invoke kind of psychoanalytic terms, notions of a deep drive for pleasure, somehow the same magnitude as a sex drive. Now, this was a 17-year-old Mexican-American gang member, and he was telling me about his favorite guns, and I can't help but think that these are subliminal terms here, right? I had me two baby nines. I fell in love with those. They looked beautiful to me. They were chrome, like perfect size. They had some power to them. I was like, damn, I really don't want to use them because I don't want to get them burned, somebody's body to it. I have them home on a shelf. I don't really use those. Those just like, I'm going to keep those for a long time. They're like tight. It's just all chrome. At the same time, guns have this really strong moral dimension to them. Most of the youths I interviewed associated guns with a form of aggressive, preemptive self-protection. And many of them spoke in a morally self-righteous way about having their guns. It's like this Mexican gang member spoke to me kind of in indignant terms about how when he carries a gun, he wouldn't even think of not using the gun. We don't choose not to use guns because it's either our life or their life. In other cases, youths would invoke these terms of enemies and moral conceptions of warfare. But guns also had a strong political, economic dimension to them as well. So to many of these youths, handguns represented a commodity for them to sell, trade, sell for drugs, favors, cash. This was a 17-year-old Mexican-American youth also. We used to get in robbing houses that have a lot of guns and trade them for pounds or ounces of cocaine, or just sell them. Living close to the border, guns are very valuable to the drug dealers. If you know the right people, you can get good deals for a gun. Another youth explained to me, I just guns to sell them, make some money off of them. That's actually what they're for. And in the interviews, I came across these kind of recurring patterns of ways of talking about the guns. Using map analysis, I coded the interviews to try and identify 19 what I call primary meanings. These were kind of associations that the youths had with guns that were automatic, immediate, an immediate response to seeing the pictures. And I can tell you a little bit about some of those 19. You've heard some of them. The first is this notion of protection, which was the most common association with guns. Now again, it's protection. It's not protection as in self-defense, as in kind of an adult conception of self-defense, having a gun under the mattress, in the glove box, in order to protect yourself against an assailant who's coming at you. It's this idea that you need to preemptively carry a gun, show the gun, flash the gun, so that people don't punk you or jump you so that you don't get disrespected. Half of the 14 of the kids had this as a primary association. And it always sounded something like this, right? When I was younger, I used to kick with those fools, and I was looking, there's a bad motherfucker right there. Look at that shit. Nobody fucks with that fool. I just wanted to be a bad motherfucker. Like, nobody crosses him. Fool's just always trying to start shit with you. But he's always trying to, like, I don't know, kind of like trying to punk you or whatever. And then when you're younger, that's when you got to fight back the most. Because once you start a reputation, you got to keep it. If you start off as getting punked and stuff, it's not good. Because then everybody tries to punk you. Protection in this sense revolves precisely around this idea of not being intimidated, right? And it requires that the gun be used publicly. Now, of course, another meaning was the commodity meaning, which I discussed earlier. And it was very recurring, often, always associated with under the fact that we were at the border, right? We're 100 miles from the border at Tucson. And guns are worth a lot to the gun trade. Another meaning was the recreation meaning. And so here, youths would immediately associate guns with hunting, target practice, shooting in the desert, other forms of recreational gun use. So it reminded them about hunting trips with their families. Here's an Anglo youth who looks at the gun and immediately starts telling me, you know, when I was like 9 years old was the first time I went shooting. We tried almost every gun there was. It was with my mom's boyfriend. 12 gauges, 20 gauges, 14 gauges, 16 gauges, elephant gun, 9mm, 45s, 44 Desert Eagles, Berettas, SKSs, Tech 9s, Tech 11s, 22s, 22 full auto, auto 25s. My mom's boyfriend, he collects them. Now, and many of these youths who think about it in this recreational term also just like the way guns handle. They like the feel of shooting a gun. One youth told me he likes reloading bullets. They like the action of the gun, the mechanism, the way it's made, how the powder works, the smell of the gun. For others, guns are about power. One youth said to me, when I think gun, it's like power, but it's power that you can't neglect. You have to respect. 10 of the youths mentioned power as a primary association with guns. And one in particular kind of associated with intimidation. This is power and specifically the idea of intimidating other people. It's funny, he told me. Like, you could just be talking to somebody and you can point a gun at somebody and they're ready to shit in their pants. Or especially if you look mad. Or if you, I don't know, it's weird. Or how easily people will give you something if you have a gun. It's funny. Using correspondence analysis, what I tried to do was kind of map the relationships between these 19 meanings to show kind of which meaning essentially went with the other meanings. This is a reproduction of a graph that's a lot smaller, and I'm not sure it's done very well in the magnifying process. But basically what correspondence analysis does is it links meanings together. So different meanings that come together often will be linked. And what I found were that there were these three registers of gun talk, three ways in which guns were discussed. The first, which is this cluster here, and it's hard to read. Maybe from the back it might be easier this time. In contrast to usual. And here it's an action protection cluster. Guns are about living in the fast lane. It's about danger, shooting, death, desire. These are always tinged with desire in this group here and a certain attraction to the guns. The second cluster was the commodity dislike cluster, in which the youth would often associate the fact that they had a gun, but they didn't really, they had guns to sell them, but they didn't really like them. Right? I don't like them, a kid told me. I just have guns to sell them, make some money off them. It's actually what they're for, explained to me. And then a third register was this recreation, respect, self-defense tool cluster here. And the idea here was that, you know, you respect a gun. It's for recreation. It's for having fun. But you don't abuse it. And so kind of typical of this was a youth who told me, I respect them. I might carry one, but I won't go around telling everyone, yeah, I got a gun. Let's go do something. Let's go in the desert. Yeah, I can shoot better than you. Yeah, I'm a sharpshooter. I don't brag about that. I know I could do it. That's the end of it. Now, the three registers capture the association, and what's particularly interesting is that they tend to stick together in different contexts and then fragment in others. So using correspondence analysis, what I did was I took the 19 meanings and then associated them with each individual, coding each individual for, first, his carrying status. Okay? So there were four different carrying status here. Someone, a youth who would always constantly have a gun on him, a youth who would carry, who had carried guns more than on one occasion, or multiple guns on different occasions, a youth who'd only carried a gun once, and then a youth who had never carried guns. And so each meaning, I would take the top five primary meanings and code them for the different status of the individuals. And you can see pretty clearly, I can talk about this later during the question and answer, how to read this, but basically, if you look at along dimension one, which goes this way, and you can collapse all of these on dimension one, you can see pretty clearly that the constant carriers and the multi-carriers, right, they were the ones who had the action, protection, belonging, cluster of meaning, death, show off, etc. In the middle was the respect, recreation, so less often would they carry. And then the ones who carried the least actually were the commodity dislike cluster. Now, this same the same clusters lined up in a different way along gang association lines. Here, although the action protection stays closely associated with the real gangsters, the recreation dislike is further than the commodity. The commodity dislike is associated with gang associations, which means someone who's not in a gang but has a lot of gang associates. And the respect recreation is furthest away from any kind of gang affiliation, which in some sense makes sense, because actually the source of guns for the commodity folks often is someone who is associated with a gang. And then when you put these up, line these up in terms of prior incarceration, you have this interesting fragmentation of the action protection cluster. So being incarcerated on a gun charge, not all of these youths were incarcerated on gun charges. In fact, a small minority of them were on gun charges. Most of them were there for auto theft. Grand auto theft was a big one. But, you know, robberies, burglaries, etc. It was only a small proportion that were in there for gun charges. Some had had previous gun charges. And so what I divided them up as folks who were in on a gun charge, folks who had a prior gun charge, and folks who had never been charged with guns. And what's interesting about here is that when you place it in that context, it kind of fragments the meaning of the guns such that the action protection, now attraction, gets actually kind of thrown out of that cluster, as does belonging. Belonging and attraction were central elements of the action protection cluster, but they are fragmented when you look at it through the lens of incarceration. Now, from a policy perspective, a first cut on this from a policy perspective is that these different registers of gun talk, or the action protection, commodity, recreation, reflect cognitive scripts among the youths. So they kind of seem to reflect these taken-for-granted ways of talking and thinking about guns, secondhand ways of reacting to guns. And it offers them a language to resist gun carrying just as much as it is a language that tempts them to carry guns. But you can hear the way in which the language can be used to resist when you think about these different recurring themes like, you know, guns are to be respected, right? That's a way for a youth to actually decide not to carry a gun. Or guns are for hunting or target shooting. Or, you know, it's more fun to scrap the old-fashioned way, hand to hand. There's this language in there that the youth can use in order to avoid gun carrying, just as much as the youth could use the language to carry. Now, it's pretty clear that the language is shared in the sense that all of the youths, in some sense, were familiar with the different meanings. I had secondary and tertiary meanings that I was able to elicit from the interviews as well. These were meanings that were not their first response to the pictures, but it was, in some sense, kind of the secondary meanings would be more developed meanings. After the free associational prompts, I would generally take them through a series of questions to try and figure out, you know, what was their experience with guns, history with guns, and what they associated with guns, and experiences with guns. Really, tell me a time that you were in a conflict, someone had a gun, didn't use it. Tell me a time you were in a conflict, someone had a gun, did use it. Right. And so you could get these different meanings in a secondary way. And then the tertiary would be, how do your friends talk about guns, you know? But the 19 meanings were recurring. Some of them were primary for the individuals, but they were familiar with the others. And they would, in some sense, you know, regenerate this language. It was as if they came to the social space of language and then used those meanings to relate to others. They weren't creating these meanings in an autonomous way. It wasn't as if they were coming to an empty space and just kind of creating a new vocabulary for guns. They were, in some sense, embedded in a linguistic structure, and they were deploying it. Now, problem is, of course, as I read and reread these interviews and struggled to draw policy implications, I confess, I began to doubt my own ability to kind of draw entirely objective policy implications about why these youths are carrying guns. How could I decide whether they were making conscious decisions to carry firearms, or whether they were passively holding guns as a result of some structural forces over which they didn't have any control, or whether they were following scripts in a taken-for-granted way? Even if we assume that gun carrying is associated with the need for self-protection in this kind of aggressive, preemptive way, how do we know that it's the need for self-protection that causes them to carry guns and not the other way around? Maybe the fact that they're carrying guns makes them feel that they need protection. Or it might be something else. It might be a justification, something that they've heard. Right? I mean, the aggressive self-protection is a current, is something that we hear over and over. It translates in the adult context into a self-defense explanation, but it's close to that. It makes the carrying of the gun justifiable, morally justifiable. We will look differently at the youth if he says, well, he's carrying it because it's my life or his life, right? He's morally entitled at that point. And how do we know that he's not just kind of responding in this way to get us to feel for him? How do we unravel these different possibilities and get a handle on human action? And the answer, I think, is pretty clearly that we don't do it very scientifically. If by science we mean empirical verification or falsification. It's true of interpreting interviews. It's equally true of interpreting quantitative data. We take a leap of faith. We have a certain sensibility. We have a certain disciplinary training. We've been brought up in certain ways to believe things about decision, deliberation, individual responsibility. And we then just kind of opt for one of these ways of thinking about human action. What I had done, in some sense, was I had deployed at least two of the, what I would say, are the four traditional approaches to social scientific inquiry. four different ways of thinking about the social world. Some of my students may have read some about these four different ways. The first is what I call phenomenological approach. And it focuses really on the internal decision-making process of the subject. In terms of the Catalina interviews, in terms of trying to interpret these youths, the first approach searches for clues about the deliberative processes of these incarcerated youths. It attempts to decipher how they think about guns, how they explain their gun carrying, how they decide to carry guns internally, right? And numerous approaches would fly under this phenomenological approach. The most conventional, traditional one is rational action theory, but also Sartrean existentialism. The idea is to get inside the brain to understand the deliberative mechanisms, to understand exactly why it is that they made this choice, with the idea that there is a choice that they are making. Obviously, though, this approach, like the other three approaches, raises a number of questions, a number of problems. I mean, when we start doing this, are we actually imposing our own meanings on these youths and our own deliberative processes on these youths? Are we actually discovering something there, or are we imposing what we think should be the way they should be thinking about carrying a gun? The second perspective is what I call structuralist, and it avoids some of these problems by moving away from the individual and looking instead at the kind of common building blocks that the individuals can use to make sense of their environment. So you can think of structural here either in terms of kind of structural forces that influence what the youths do, or linguistic structuralism. Which is the idea of kind of these registers. They are out there. The structures of language are out there. That's what we need to try and understand. And once we've understood those structures, we can understand what the choices are, what the individual choices are. Now, the problem, of course, is that those structures present a formal constraint on the individual, but they don't really dictate what the individual is going to do. I mean, this was always the problem with Levi-Straussian structural linguistics and the distinction between langue and parole, right? Langue is the structure of language. Parole is what you actually say, the utterance. Langue doesn't determine what you say, right? It determines how you say it, but it doesn't determine what you actually say. And here, of course, the registers are there. They may determine how the youths talk and think about guns, but they don't determine which particular register a youth is going to use, right? They're not formal constraints on action. The third perspective, which builds on the structural, tries to explore how the structures might, in fact, influence an individual. This is probably closest to the semiotic approach that I take in my work. This treats the structures as, in some sense, well-tread paths, right? Ways of thinking that might, in fact, condition future behavior. So, if it is true that these ways of talking offer certain scripts or narratives for the individual, then those scripts and narratives may become second nature. They may become absorbed by the individual, and as a result, they may start to condition the way that the individual behaves. Number of theories here, ranging from Pierre Bourdieu's practice theory to behavioral law and economics and the notion of heuristics, to new institutional approaches in sociology. The question here, of course, is what would it mean for an individual to follow a script, right? What does it mean for the script to have some kind of power over the individual? The final and fourth perspective is what I call a performative approach to social phenomena. And here, what you do is you basically kind of eliminate the individual actor from the equation. It's no longer that there's an individual deciding. It's no longer that there's an individual following a script. It's that basically the individual, the identity, is created by actions that are taken. There's no individual behind the doing. There is just the identity that is created by the actions. Oftentimes, this fourth approach is kind of modeled on discourse, on the way we talk, the way we iterate things and reiterate things, and in the process of iterating things, slightly change things. It sounds a little bit abstract, but I mean, here would be an example of this. Taking any of this language, taking any of these registers, and then changing them just a little bit, so that every time that someone uses these registers, they change them a little bit. There isn't an individual who is then controlled by these. There is just this changing map of language and of things that are being said. And so when the youth, you know, pulls out a gun and changes slightly what he says, in the process, he is creating a new language that is all the time changing. Right, but there is no narrative behind this. There is no constant individual. There is only a series of actions. Now, these are four different ways of, in some sense, interpreting this data, of interpreting any data, of interpreting a multiple regression analysis, of interpreting a complex data set. And the question is, how do we choose between them? How do we choose which approach to take? And the answer is that we really don't have a scientific way of choosing. There is evidence for each one of these. There's evidence in the interviews for deterrence. There's evidence that some of these kids are deterred by the price of the time that you would do if you carry a gun. Some of these kids will say, I don't mess around with guns. It's too much time. Other kids, I had a kid who says, you know, I don't think about the police when I'm carrying my gun because it might jinx me. Right? I mean, I don't know. There's a problem with deterrence there, I take it, right? there's evidence of scripts and narratives. You just over and over you hear the same thing about these kids. They talk about, you know, getting dogged and talking shit. Getting dogged means being stared at. And what it leads to, being stared at, is talking shit, which means this kind of banter where you say, you know, what do you want? You know, and then it just kind of escalates. You know, fuck you, fuck your mother, fuck this, fuck that. You know, it's got a rhythm, it's got a cadence to it. But it happens over and over and over and over and over again. And these youths know that that's what happens if you start down that road. They know that if you dog someone, that's what's going to happen, and it's going to escalate. Those are scripts. There's evidence that the scripts change all the time, which is this notion of reiteration and performance. And, of course, there is this language out there. So, I mean, we've got evidence, in some sense, for four different kind of methodological approaches, and no real way to say, well, no, this one's wrong, it's false, it's falsified, I can pull a null hypothesis on this. You just can't do it. And we don't do it. What we do is we gravitate towards a methodological approach that we are comfortable with. It might be rational choice theory. It might be scripts. And what I suggest is that what we need to do is ask a different question. So the question is not, you know, is it right that there's rational choice going on here? The real question is, what do you have to believe that there's rational choice going on here? What are the implications of believing that there is rational choice here? At what cost do we decide that this is a script or a performance? Right? At what cost to the youths do we decide that? The central question then is, how does a theoretical approach become believable at any particular time, under specific historic conditions, and at what price? And what I argue is that this isn't in any way paralyzing. It actually offers us a much better way of thinking about the relationship between social science and public policy. And that in the process, what we need to do is adopt a concept of dirty hands. That there's an ethical choice in the adoption of any methodological approach. It's the ethical choice of going through and trying to understand what the consequences are for these youths if we try to interpret their actions in any one particular way. That involves an ethical dimension. Now, in my work, I try to set out what my ethical choices are. The first is that I refuse to take the leap of faith that's necessary to believe that these youths can't in any way be changed. It's a leap of faith. There's evidence from some of their behavior, there's evidence from some of what they say that they're torn between a life of crime and wanting to stay clean. And we have examples of individuals who come out of juvenile detention and do pretty remarkable things. Senator, Colorado, I forget his name right now. But in any event, one senator we had was in juvenile detention as a kid, right? I mean, there are cases of change. Second ethical choice. I refuse to kind of adopt an entirely calculating and callous abstract attitude towards the costs and implications of all of this. So, for instance, Steve Levitt in his work talks about kind of annual spending per juvenile is $33,000, annual spending for an adult is $23,000, $10,000 cheaper to house an adult in prison than it is to have a juvenile in prison. So, if that's right, then we might favor adult incarceration over juvenile incarceration. Now, my response is no. I mean, if juvenile detention is going to serve as a deterrent that will in some way avoid this individual spending his time as an adult incarcerated, then we need to make the investment. I refuse to sacrifice their future as adults. A third ethical choice, and here I kind of resist the temptation of some critical cultural theorists to suggest that it's the youth's resistance to structures of oppression that is what leads to these self-destructive behaviors. And so in some sense, that only sees self-destruction as the product of explicit reaction to racism, classism, inequality, etc. And I want to say, no, I think I see in some of their resistance something that may be useful to them, that may actually, in some cases, save their lives. It may not always be wise what they do, but some of it has value. Now, overarching these three different specific ethical choices is a larger ethical project, to treat these youths the way I would treat my children, or you. Or myself. So to listen to the Catalina youths the way I would listen to my children, to extend to them the kind of respect and dignity that I afford my own children. Notice I didn't say to treat them the way I would treat my own children. I'm not that righteous. But to try to understand what's going on. And when I do, what I see are the correlations between the different languages, the different registers, and different modalities, and possibly different policy orientations. The youths who think of guns as a commodity, right, are more likely to be receptive to a rational choice-based approach than the youths who see guns as action, protection, self-defense, preemption from being assaulted. And as a result, it's possible to use the language of guns to identify different approaches to different sets of kids. The recreation language itself is not associated with much caring, is not associated with much violence. It could be that there's no point prosecuting in a situation where someone's out in the desert shooting at cacti. Right? It could be that what we need to adopt is a deterrence-oriented policy towards kids who are viewing guns as a commodity, because that works, and practice-oriented approaches for kids, for youths who are, you know, clustered around guns as a form of self-protection. And so the bottom line is basically to try and listen to them, to try and understand these youths, so as to then develop policies that can kind of work on the context, the relationship between how they talk about guns and what might be working or what might work to help them kind of avoid the dangers of gun use and gun carrying. All right, let me stop there, I think. Yes? Okay, that's it. And why don't I take some questions? If you have any. Yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't, and that's a that would be a great thing to do. I mean, I have no doubt that the specific registers of gun talk that were present here were somehow associated with the cultural context of being close to the border in the Southwest. So, at the border, in the Southwest, in a place where guns are extremely accessible, right? I mean, guns are, you know, in Arizona, a lot of people have guns. It's really easy to get your hand on a gun. And I think that the language of guns would change. There would be significant changes in other areas as a result of, you know, being in the Northeast, not having access to guns, not having border issues, stronger gang cultures, etc. So, I mean, I think it would be fascinating to do that. You would... Clearly, if you are going to be trying to use these registers to understand and to formulate policy, you would need to have a textured analysis that would go through and actually kind of do this kind of work in the different setting where you're trying to avoid gun use, right? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there was a point in time. I did have, one of the meanings was a kind of, I will use this gun to kill other people. There was a kill meaning on there. But there weren't enough of those. That was a really small subset for me to actually be able to kind of distinguish or to kind of formulate any kind of large scale kind of implications about that. That was a pretty small subset and a pretty small meaning, but it did exist. I mean, so there was, as part of the kind of caring for action, etc., this idea that, you know, I'm actually going to go out there when I have a gun, I'm going to use it, and I intend to kill somebody. It wasn't significant enough that I could, like, cluster it out, which left me then with those caring statuses instead. Allison.
Well,
it chose me in some sense. I mean, I had four different sites, and I was unable to get the three others to approve it ultimately. So, that's one of the reasons. I wanted to go to a space where there was high caring. The highest caring is among incarcerated male youths. So all of the survey analysis shows that about 85% of incarcerated male youths of this age have carried guns. So that's why I targeted the juvenile detention center in Tucson. But I also wanted to target two high schools and a population of highly supervised youths on probation. And those three wouldn't allow me to actually do the interviews. But the Catalina School would. So, I mean, I was looking for kind of high-risk youth offenders in detention or under high supervisory versus kind of more lower risk who would have been in the high schools.
Just out of curiosity,
yeah.
Did you go through an IRB, and if so, which one?
I went through the University of Arizona IRB. Yeah. And IRBs are institutional review boards that essentially are human subjects. It's to protect human subjects from experimentation and so that we don't just kind of, you know, give people medicines to see what happens and what color you know if you turn green or you know what happens to you, but they obviously now have kind of like extended their reach and they apply to sociological studies. Juveniles are a highly protected group, and as a result of that, it's practically impossible today to get to juveniles. So they're more protected than an adult group would be. Yes.
I know you said that the choice of policy is sort of a leap of faith or a choice of approach. But I was wondering, when you talked about the practice theories, practice approaches, I was wondering if you could give more specific examples of whether those have been tried. What would that actually
be? Okay, so what it translates into, there are in some sense practice-oriented policies that translate into things like conflict resolution strategies, right? So, I mean, programs that would deal with youth to try and teach them ways of resolving conflict, right? And that's a practice oriented in the sense that you actually kind of experience what it is like to go through the steps, right? You are shown, okay, wait a minute, if this conflict is taking place, you can actually engage in these behaviors in order to try and wind your way out of that conflict situation. So that would be more of a practice-oriented. But I mean, practice-oriented ranges, I mean, it's really trying to create different, trying to show individuals different ways of possibly practicing life, right? But it also ranges to things like midnight basketball, which in some sense is a practice-oriented approach, right? Because what it tries to do is basically get youth who would be, you know, at the Burger King parking lot at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock flashing colors to be on a basketball court instead, right? So that too is in some sense a practice-oriented approach.
Right? Behind? So you see the fall off in the rate of youth gun homicide. Is that correlated with the use of
Right. Well, you definitely want to try and make sure that you're not implementing policies that coincide with dramatic increases in crime. The problem is that dramatic increases and dramatic reductions in crime are often the result of exogenous factors. And so we've seen over the course of the 1990s one of the sharpest drops in crime in the United States, across the nation, across every sector of the nation, And so the real tough job becomes then to try and hold constant what's going on at a national level and try to determine whether or not the particular practices that you're engaged with in a particular jurisdiction is having any effect, right? But those are things, those are things that need to be done as, in some sense, kind of alongside this, right? And for that, we have, criminologists who can do, program evaluation, basically, right? Yeah.
Are there any of those 19 you think are so linked to the drug trade that policy just won't be able to do much about them?
Okay, good question. Yeah, there are many, the action protection cluster is so heavily linked to gangs and drugs that you could possibly say, in light of that, deal with the gang problem, right? And deal with the gang selling drugs problem and forget about the rest of this stuff. In other words, for those youths who are in that cluster, it's pretty clear that the most important thing to do would be to try and deal with the gang problem, okay? Which could be a different soup of policies, right? Yeah.
I'm just wondering about some of these. It's interesting because there's a realm in which this has to just be understood on its own terms without all instant policy translation.
Right.
But
yeah.
You brought forth a lot of the psychoanalytic aspects. It's close affiliation with vocabulary of sex and the sexual drives. On the other hand, you've clearly got incarcerated youths.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if there are studies that you can work with and look at correlations to other registers, the language of the gun, the language of sex. Mm-hmm. You have studies that deplore among the same set of males sexual promiscuity and irresponsibility. Mm-hmm. And you also have a clear correlation with behavior among the same set of males where they get themselves incarcerated for often extremely stupid reasons. And it just triggered my thought when you said the guy said didn't want to jinx himself about the thought of the police. Mm-hmm. If I can put on my gun, I don't have to worry about the incarceration vocabulary. I don't have to worry about the I might get arrested. Cause and effect thinking. I'm going to worry about cause and effect as far as my gun use, but not cause and effect as far as whether it might get me arrested and incarcerated. Are there studies that sort of look at these and say which of these symbolic registers overlap, which ones are compatible with each other, and which ones just say if I flip this one goes off?
No, that's great. That would be great. It doesn't exist. But that would be great. I mean, I think that the study of social meaning, right? There was a social meaning movement in law that occurred in the mid-1990s, but it was more of a kind of abstract, theoretical discussion, assuming what social meanings were. Right? And so to this date, I still don't think that we have many studies that actually try to map meanings and find out what they are. But I have no doubt that it would be incredibly useful to try and map on language of sexuality. And possibly also the other kind of, do other semiotics of other objects that are in some sense of equal kind of sensual nature, right? I mean, the gun to these youths is of an incredible sensual nature, but there are some other objects like that. Cars. Right? And so it would be really important to try and figure out, what the language there is. Sex also. But this is work that needs to be done. It's not out there yet. Marcia, how much time do we have? None.
Probably none.
None. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming.